Today's episode of The Grave Talks is brought to you by the 5-star rated puzzle game Best Fiends. Download the 5-star rated puzzle game Best Fiends free today on the Apple App Store or Google Play. That's friends without the R, Best Fiends. Today on The Grave Talks, Home Investigations, a conversation with Angel Vejo. From the age of 8, Angel Vejo knew she had a gift for seeing the dead. After a late-night encounter with what appeared to be her dying grandfather, Angel would soon discover her gift went far beyond the normal. Slowly ushered into the paranormal world by her pioneering paranormal investigator mother, Angel would go on to dedicate the next 40 years of her life to helping those affected by the supernatural. This is her story.
My mom and my aunties, they all three of them could communicate with spirits. So they taught me early, like when I was 8 years old is when the lessons began. So yeah, I've been around it all my life.
So what was that like for you as an 8-year old? And what sort of, did you see any signs of them having these abilities before the lessons began? Walk me up to kind of how that all began and how you absorbed that as a child.
My earliest memory would be watching my mom and her sisters sitting around a table with their crystals, and my mom, she would draw pictures of people. My Aunt Shirley would just kind of pick up on the energy that was in the room, and my Aunt Janet would, she could write scripture. So as the spirits were communicating with her, she would write down what they were saying. So it was a unique experience as a child. Now, back then, obviously, I didn't know what they were doing. All of that didn't come into play for me personally until I was probably in my early teens. Mm-hmm. But seeing it and being around it from when you're a little girl, you know, like, nothing really surprises me, and you know, like, at all as an adult. But even back then, there was no fear. There was... I mean, it was my mom. I knew my mom had my back. I knew she wouldn't do anything to put me in harm's way. So it was just kind of fascinating when I was a kid.
Sure. I mean, when you're a kid and you're seeing, you know, your trusted adults and things of that nature doing things, you trust that it's okay. This is life. This is normal. In many right. aspects, you look at it and think, everybody's mom must do this, or this is just a common thing, and you don't realize how uncommon it may be until you get a bit older. So walk me into that area. You said around 8 is when the lessons started. Tell me about that.
Yeah. I was actually in my mom's bedroom. She was across the hallway to our neighbor's house. And I was doing the typical kid thing, you know, doing something I shouldn't have been doing. Mm-hmm. And I was in her room and I was like fiddling through her jewelry, just, you know, just wanting to be a kid and look at her pretty stuff. And she had this dresser with a mirror on it. And I was looking in the mirror because I put her necklace on around my neck, and I'm looking, and like this white wispy cloud, I guess is how I would describe it. I could see it in the mirror to my left in the corner. And I turned around and looked, and I could still see it. It wasn't just in the mirror. I could see it with my own eyes. And as I stood there, it took maybe, I'd say, less than a minute to completely manifest. But at the very end of the manifestation, I saw a tall man standing there with his arms folded, black-rimmed glasses, and he looked fairly annoyed with me. didn't know why, didn't know who he was. You know, but I that was the first time I ever seen an apparition, but it was also the first time and only time I've ever seen one manifest from a mist to a full body person. Never seen that since then. But it startled me, you know, not because it, you know, it was a ghost. It startled me because I thought I was in trouble for doing something I shouldn't have been doing, which was touching my mom's jewelry. So when she came back, I fessed up and I told her, I said, Mommy, I was playing with your stuff and there was a man in your room. And of course she was startled. She says, well, who came in the house? And I said, no. I said, Mommy, I think it was a ghost. And she says, well, can you describe him to me? So I described, you know, what he looked like to her. And she got this funny look on her face. She goes out of the bedroom into the kitchen, and she gets on the phone to call one of my aunts. And I can hear her talking to my Aunt Shirley saying, I think she just saw Dad, which would have been her dad, you know, my grandfather, who I had never met. When the opportunity arose that I could have met him, he had already been deathly sick. And they didn't want that to be the only impression of this man for me because I was so young. Mm-hmm. So they didn't take me to the hospital. So I had never met him. But she says to, you know, my Aunt Shirley, she says, I think she just saw Dad. So she got off the phone with her and she brought me into the living room, sat me down on the couch. And she says, okay, she's no, you know, I know, you know what spirits are. I know, you know what the afterlife is. She says, but do you realize who you saw? And I said, no. And she said, that would have been your grandfather, John. And I knew he was sick, but I said, well, does that mean he's dead? And she's no. She said, I just talked to Aunt Shirley. He's in the hospital. He's still very much alive. But we're kind of perplexed right now. Well, she didn't say perplexed. She said, we're confused.
Sure.
I said, okay. I said, did I do something wrong? And she said, no. But I think it's beginning. And I said, what's beginning? And she says, I think we need to lead you on the right path with this. She says, you have a gift that none of us have. And I'm not quite sure how to handle this. So from that point, that night at 10:13 at p.m., she got a phone call and my grandpa passed away. So this would have been about five and a half hours later that I actually saw his apparition in her bedroom that he passed away. So I saw him before he died.
Yeah.
So that was kind of a shock to my mom. Because she knew I was going to have abilities because it just runs in the family, but she didn't know what to do with that because she had never dealt with it. So from that point on, from the age of 8 till about 13, it was just, there was no investigations involved. It was just straight, you know, observing her and the sisters, listening to them, you know, teach me. And fortunately, I was a very willing student, and I absorbed knowledge like a sponge. So even back then as a child, I was able to retain a lot of what they were explaining to me. And most 8-year-olds probably couldn't have, but I was kind of born into it. So it was natural for me. It wasn't paranormal. It was normal.
Mm-hmm.
So that's how my life in it got started as an individual, was seeing my grandfather's spirit before he even died.
And the fact that it was kind of embraced by your family, it wasn't, oh, you're seeing things, or it's just your imagination. They accepted it as fact. This happened to you.
And I do realize how blessed I was with that, because I've been doing this for 40 years. And I'd say 90% of the people that are into the paranormal now had parents that told them exactly what you said. You're crazy. You're imagining things. You know, there's nothing in your closet. There's nobody there. You know, they were taught to believe that they weren't seeing what they were really seeing or hearing.
Mm-hmm.
And that's sad, you know. So I was very blessed to have a mom and aunties that embraced it, understood it, and taught it to me.
How do you think, we hear that quite often, where people will say, you know, mom and dad said, oh, you know, you're not seeing it, da 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 da. And then some people say in the ability then kind of shut off. And maybe later in life they rediscovered it, maybe they did not. But that's quite often kind of how the story goes for so many people. Do you think that's a thing where being told that it's your imagination, being dismissed with it, that actually is the trigger that shuts that ability off if you have it as a child? Or is it something that just kind of either stays with some people and fades for others? Just like eyesight. If somebody keeps telling you you're seeing blurry, it doesn't mean you're going to start seeing blurry. Your eyes are either going to stay strong or they're not.
Completely
beyond your control. Just, it's an opinion question, but what do you think?
I don't think it definitely does more harm than good, especially for people that are born with these abilities.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't think that it shuts it off. I think it goes dormant.
Mm-hmm.
It's always there. But if you're told over and over again, it's your imagination, you're crazy, it's not there, you know, your brain begins to believe it. So your ability just kind of get pushed under the radar, you know, and they're still there, but they're just not utilized. And if you don't learn how to utilize them early enough, then, you know, by the time you're an adult and you embrace it and you think back and you know what, my parents should have believed me because it's real. You're so far behind, you know what I mean, that it can be a little overwhelming for an adult because there's so much to learn and so much to experience. Mm-hmm. That adult brains, and that's the other thing, you know, an adult brain perceives a spirit differently than a child's does. You know, their minds, most children are very open, you know, they haven't been taught, you know, they haven't taught their brains to not see something like adults have. You know, they're a little bit more pure and a little bit more innocent when looking at things. So by the time you're an adult, you know, if you've been trained to not see those things and then you suddenly do, just out of nowhere, I know people specifically that have called me for counseling because all those years they shut it off. And then all of a sudden they go on a hunt and boom, it's like they're overwhelmed with their powers and their abilities. Mm-hmm. And they don't know how to deal with it. It's overwhelming and it can be scary. So to any parents out there that are listening, when your children come to you, please, please listen. Listen with an open mind because you're doing so much more harm. You know, you can have those children growing up thinking that there's something really wrong with them and it's not. Mm-hmm. There's nothing wrong with it. So that's always my advice to parents.
Back to the conversation in just a moment. First, I want to thank our supporter today, Best Fiends. Not that long ago, I was kind of trying to find a good puzzle game, a good matching puzzle game that I could, you know, have as kind of my mental palate cleanser, if you will. It's always nice to have something like that. And I was trying to find something to be a good challenge, wouldn't get bored with. And let me tell you, Best Fiends has really come through as being that mobile puzzle game that I was searching for. The more and more I play it, the more and more I get in to this thing. I truly do. It's way more fun than any other matching puzzle game I've ever played. And let me tell you, they're always updating it too. There's thousands of puzzles, there's thousands of characters, and every time you play, you're going to run into something new, which is really awesome. And you can challenge yourself, challenge your friends, get to whatever level, you know, you're trying to go back and forth with your friends and stuff going, oh, where are you at? I'm over here. It's just fun. Check it out for yourself. Best Fiends. You're never going to get bored with this thing, trust me. And it really, it keeps your brain active when you're trying to, you know, zone out a little bit. All sorts of new stuff all the time, collectible characters. It just keeps coming. Download the 5-star rated puzzle game Best Fiends free today on the App Store or Google Play. That's Friends Without the R, Best Fiends. After you had that experience at 8 and it was embraced by your family, tell me about that span of time between like 8 and 13 as you kind of started to learn more from your mom and your aunts. Did you have more experiences in that time window?
Not with specific spirits per se. I had experiences with energy and how to protect myself. You know, I learned, you know, how to look for spirits that are, you know, that want to cross over. And, you know, I really didn't have any experiences. My mom, once she realized my gifts had kicked in, she didn't want to rush me into that life yet. She wanted me to learn and absorb as much as I could academically, you know, and spiritually before I got into that. So she taught me how to kind of shut that realm off from my existence so I could focus on my studies as opposed to trying to focus on studies and dealing with the dead. You know, it was a little too much for a young child to take on, and she knew that.
Sure. And how did you handle that? I mean, being, you know, when you're getting in that age range, usually one of the last things, you know, a child, a little girl wants to do is, oh, let's do everything that that mom is doing or my aunts are doing in the realm of ghosts or spirits or things of that nature. You're starting to develop your own interests and things of that nature. What was your openness to all of this? I mean, knowing that you had this ability, but how were you in terms of accepting it and wanting it even?
Impatient.
Yeah.
I was very impatient. I still am as an adult. I'm not ashamed to admit that.
Sure.
But back then, yeah, I wanted to go around where the spirits were. I wanted to go on the private residential cases my mom was going on. I wanted to be a part of it, but she just, you know, she says, no, you have to learn first because you have to be able to control your gifts. You have to be able to control the onslaught of the spirits coming to you. You know, I mean, by the time I was 11 or 12 years old, you know, it all made sense. And I understood why I had to be patient. But up until that point, yeah, it wasn't an easy task to just get me to just want to learn and not be involved in it.
So your mom was actively investigating. It wasn't just your mom and her sisters at home, you know, kind of just exercising their gifts. They were actually out there trying to help people and being part
of
this.
My mom was.
And my mom was. And mm-hmm. I'm assuming this is a time window. I mean, what years are we talking here?
Oh, my goodness. Very late 70s, early 80s.
Sure. So we're talking a time period where this was still not exactly open, you know, for discussion in most circles. This is even pre-Unsolved Mysteries. This is, you know, this is, you know, very kind of a taboo subject. There wasn't ghost teams and ghost investigators and all that out there at the time. So, I mean, how did that hit you? I mean, I know you saw it on a normal basis, but, you know, just socially, friends, how did those conversations go? Did you ever discuss what mom was doing or anything like that?
No, those conversations were not had, but between myself, my mom, and the aunties. Just because back then, you know, let alone if you were to tell somebody you were seeing things and confused about it, they thought you were crazy. But if you could see things and admitted that you could see things and you knew what they were, you were psychotic, you know? So she did not want the ridicule of what she knew would come with it, especially a child being involved in it. So, no, that was like the number one rule. You know, you don't, unless mommy says it's okay, you don't talk about it. This is between us.
Sure.
Yeah. So
when your mom was out there, what was she doing in terms of, what was her goal when she went out to investigate? Was she trying to help people? What was her abilities and what was she doing?
That was always her goal. And that's why she did it, was to help families that were scared, confused, being tormented, you know, things like that. Her goal was to go into the homes, find out who was there, why they were there. You know, if they were tormenting family, find out why and try to absolve it. Her main thing in going to most houses was to teach the living and the dead how to coexist with one another. That was her. That was the main goal for her. She didn't go to exorcise demons. She didn't, you know, it wasn't anything like that. It was strictly to help the families, make them feel at ease. If the spirits needed to feel at ease, she would do that too. That was just her. That was her MO.
How did she begin doing that, especially back in that time window where, again, this wasn't something that was common at all? I mean, even to get the idea that even if you have the ability to decide, I'm going to go and help people with these sort of situations, where did that all begin for her?
Honestly, I don't know exactly when it started. I know it was when she really got to the point that she knew that she could help people. I was a baby. So it wouldn't have been until I was born in 73. So by the age of, you know, by the year 75, I think, is when her and my Aunt Shirley decided, you know what, we were given these gifts for a reason. We need to do something with it. And then it just kind of took off from there. But Yeah, she was around this town. She was more or less known as the spiritualist. She, you know, people knew to call her for spiritual counseling, for paranormal counseling. She was just the person. So
growing up in that environment, of course, it leads to your curiosity and realizing that you have those gifts too. So tell me more about how that all progressed for you as you got into be a teenager in those years. When did you start, you know, using some of the skills that you had and some of the abilities that you had, you know, beyond just, you know, having the experiences that you did on your own?
When she officially took me on my very first investigation, it was at the Hotel Conneaut in Conneaut Lake, PA. That's where she grew up. There's a whole history behind that hotel and my family. But she thought that would be the ideal place to take me first. So that was my first official investigation, and that was in 1982. And I'm sorry, no, 1983. And it was an experience that I will never forget. It was the first time that I had ever been touched by a spirit. And, you know, back then we didn't have the equipment that we have now. Not even close. We had the portable cassette tape recorder. We had pendulums. We had dowsing rods and cameras. I mean, that was the extent of the equipment back then.
Mm-hmm.
That was the first time I actually felt a spirit touch my hand. But again, you know, she knew what she was doing, because if she had just said, you know what, you got abilities, let's go, that probably would have freaked me out. But because I had 5 years of training for that moment, and I wasn't caught off guard. I was excited. You know, and when something touches you that you can't see for the first time, it's mind blowing, you know, but instead of scaring me away or anything, that was the moment that I knew this was going to be my life.
Mm-hmm.
This is going to be my passion. And it has been for the last 40 years.
So you had that experience at that hotel. Tell me more about that first investigation. What were some of those moments in there that really walk us through what that was like? Having the experience, I mean, you have obviously had some personal experiences, but having that
right
experience on an investigation, you know, what was that night like?
It was kind of surreal, because I half expected to go in there and have my mom, you know, kind of dictate to me what to do, what to say, but she didn't. She pretty much just let me run amok, and, you know, if you feel something, stop. That was about the only advice she would give me that day, was if you feel something, stop, because chances are it's somebody there and they want to communicate. So that whole evening at the hotel was more or less to show me the awareness of when somebody is around that I can't see. And that's pretty much what it was. There were certain spots in the hotel that got me to stop in my tracks. And, you know, I would get the hairs on my arms would stand up, and, you know, just certain telltale signs that I was onto something. But that's pretty much all that happened there. I didn't see anything. I just, you know, I got touched, and I could feel their energy source, but that was the extent of it.
What was it like talking with your mom, you know, after going on your first investigation? This is something you've been primed now to do for many years, and there you mm-hmm. are. I would imagine, you know, just as a parent, if I were in your mom's shoes, it'd be like kind of a moment of being proud of your child. And what was that relationship like there, you know, once you were kind of both on the same page of you're doing this sort of thing together?
She honestly cried. When we left the hotel, we were probably about 20 steps away from the front porch. And she just stopped. She turned around. She looked at the hotel. We were still holding hands as we were crossing. And when she stopped, she held onto my hand and had me turn around and look at it. And she says, "What do you think?" And I said, I think the hotel is pretty, Mama. And she says, no. What do you think? What do you think about how you felt inside there? And she said, were you scared at all? I said, no. And she just started crying. Like, that's all she needed to know was that I wasn't scared. Nothing else mattered. But I think as a mom, she didn't want to feel like she was pushing me in a direction that I was not comfortable with or that I was going to be afraid of. And once she discovered that I was fine, I'm ready to go, you know,
yeah.
At 13, I'm ready to go.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, she cried. That's the only thing she could have done because there was nothing left to be said.
Yeah. I mean, it's quite a moment, and it's an interesting thing because you have so many moments of, oh, you know, the parents are proud of their child because they got this grade or they did that sport. Of course, this is something you'd be proud of, too. I mean, in my world, I'd be just as proud, I think, as your mom if my daughter.
Right.
And she's already co-hosting one of the shows with me and is like the catalyst in my world of like, let's go investigate Dad. She's only 8. And like, let's wait a few years. Let's just wait a little bit on that. You can keep co-hosting, but let's wait. But no, I get that. And that's a really unique thing and a unique bond to have over really a topic and kind of a passion that will last a lifetime. You know, it's not just, you're in this sport or this event or this class right now. This is something that I'm assuming for you guys went on for many, many years.
Oh, yeah. Up until she got sick. She passed away 8 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, up until that point, you know, she got to a point, you know, she got older. She couldn't go on the residential cases. And,
sure.
You know, she would just send me to deal with it. And then I would, you know, consult with her if I needed anything. But, yeah, she just, I think when she got to the point that my girl's okay. She can do this. She's good to go. I think, you know, she stepped down and let me take that spot. So
walk me into, you're doing this now, you know, let's go back further, not like necessarily into today, but you have this, your first case, you have this experience with your mom. How do things progress from there? Walk me through the next handful of years and some of the more of the bigger highlights that you look back upon. I don't know if fondly is the right word, but I guess the ones that are more dramatic to you or stand out as very interesting experiences and cases that you had a chance to look into.
Oh, you mean with my mom or by myself?
Either or.
Well, after the hotel and that investigation, we would go to cemeteries and things like that, but she never took me on any investigation after that other than private cases.
Mm-hmm.
She felt those were more important, you know, because the whole point of having a gift is to help people.
Sure.
You pass along that gift. So her big thing was always the residential cases. So
let's talk
up
about
until I'd say she was 60. We had been on probably 40 to 50 different cases together. And none of them ever consisted of having to deal with demonic activity or anything like that. Out of all those cases, it was at the most a disgruntled, you know, spirit that didn't like his space preoccupied by other people. And, you know, we had to find a way for everybody to call a truce kind of thing. But those were really the most challenging ones was the, you know, the spirits that just couldn't accept that somebody else lived in their space kind of thing. But it wasn't until, when I got to the part of the paranormal journey, when I was going to like paranormal destinations, like, you know, Waverly and these bigger, more popular things, I actually didn't even start doing that until 6 years ago. Prior to that, it was just residential cases. You know, just it wasn't a big part of my life until I got published. When I became a published author, my publisher is the one that, you know, said that, you know, you have all this experience, you have all this knowledge, you can teach people. And you know, you should write a book. so that kind of got me started thinking about going to, you know, haunted destinations and checking them out and investigating. Because, like I said, that's just not something that my mom did. Mm-hmm. It was always about helping families and people.
Yeah, and
so aspect of it, I really didn't have much experience in.
And that's area I'm most interested in, is the area of helping people and the private investigations.
Right.
And not everything has to be demonic to be exciting.
Thank you.
Tell me about some of those cases that you remember that really stand out to you. Obviously, you have, you know, quite a few under your belt there, but there, I'm sure there's a few that really, you know, you look back on and maybe wonder about to this day. Or you know, are just, you know, you have those memories because it was something that was meaningful to you. Tell me about some of those private cases and what happened and how that went.
I think the best one is I had a case in Newcastle, Pennsylvania, and it was a single mom with two little boys, twin boys. And she couldn't see, hear, nothing that they were. They were both 6 years old, obviously twins. They were 6 years old. And she called me one night and she's like, I don't know what to do. She says, they're telling me something's in the closet. They won't sleep in their room. You know, they're this or that. They freak out. They cry. She says, I don't know what's going on. So I went, and within 10 minutes of being there, I knew that these two little boys had gifts. And they could see and sense things. And I hate calling it a test, but when I realized what they had, I just kind of asked them, I was like, can you walk somewhere and you let me know, just like my mom did with me, can you let me know if you feel any different when you get to a spot? That's all I want you to do. And they would walk to a spot and I would go over with my equipment and my own senses. And they would be spot on. And I told her, I said, okay, first things first, your boys are gifted. So this is not going to be just a rare occasion that they're going to see things that may scare them as children. So, you know, before I go any further with this case, I need to know where you stand with that. You know, are you going to encourage them to build on their abilities, or are you going to push them aside? Because if you're going to push them aside, then I need to get somebody else in here that can, you know, help me figure out what's in the closet. Because whatever they were afraid of was in the closet. And I said, whatever, you know, whoever's in there, I need somebody else here to help me. Because if they need to cross over, you know, I need help to do that. Because I won't take on that chore by myself. I just won't. And she really, I saw the turmoil in this woman's eyes, because I later found out, you know, her husband was very religious. He was convinced that anybody that could see ghosts were, you know, of evil descendant, you know, and, you know, if you're seeing ghosts, then that's the tool of the devil and, you know, all this nonsense. And I was, for the first time, and that was probably my 65th or 67th, I can't remember, I'd have to look at my logbook, case that I had done on my own, that I was really dumbfounded. I didn't know what to do. So my biggest chore was to teach the boys, you know, not to be afraid, and you know, give them as much help as I could possibly do. So the woman says, well, I don't want you to do anything else. I need to talk to my husband. Can I call you back? Yes, if you need me to come back, I'll come back. So a week later, she calls me, and she found one of the little boys sitting in the closet talking to somebody that she couldn't see. But he wasn't scared. He was literally sitting Indian style in the closet, playing with little toys and talking to somebody, just at complete peace and contentment. And when I went back over, I asked the little boy who he saw and asked him if it was the same person that was scaring him. Here, there was another child. I don't know what the history was, but there was a little boy that had passed away on the property. And he had sunken eyes, and he just, you know, he looked like a little dead boy to the living boy. And but things that I said to the twins before I left that week prior, you know, don't be afraid. You know, sometimes they look scary. They don't mean to. You know, I did as much as I could to help them little boys accept whoever they were seeing, because I knew it wasn't anything evil. I knew that. I could feel the energy. It was nothing, anything like that. And all of a sudden, I mean, she called me back maybe 2 weeks later. She says, I don't know how you did it. Don't know what you did. Don't know what you told them boys. But they're not afraid anymore. They go to bed happily. Like, and that was the end of it. It was just a little simple. I didn't even have to investigate. All I had to do was make sure them two little boys knew that they had nothing to be afraid of. That's all it took. It was that simple of a case. That one will always stick out to me because it was so simple, and because it just literally came down to, you know, if you take away that fear factor, it opens up a whole new world.
That wraps up part one of our conversation with Angel. In part two, why do some spirits manifest themselves in a scary form, even if they do not want to scare the living? What are some of Angel's biggest frustrations when investigating a private home haunting from both the living and the dead? What's going on when we see ghosts of the living? And does paranormal tourism ramp up the level of paranormal activity in select locations? We'll talk about all of that and more in part two. To hear it, become a Gravekeeper. That's a supporter of our show. Go to patreon.com/thegravetalks to support the show and get access to all of our episodes from our entire archive of shows, advanced episodes of the show, and our exclusive part twos available to Gravekeepers only. Again, patreon.com/thegravetalks to support the program and help keep us on the air and get all of those extras. Until next time, for The Grave Talks, I'm Tony Bruschi. Thanks for listening.